Life and Times of Jesus the Messiah. Chapter 5. Further incidents of the journey to Jerusalem, the mission and return of the 70, the home at Bethany, Martha and Mary. Although, for the reasons explained in the previous chapter, the exact succession of events cannot be absolutely determined, it seems most likely that it was on his progress southwards at this time that Jesus designated those 70 others who were to herald his arrival in every town and village. Even the circumstance that the instructions to them are so similar to, and yet distinct from, those formerly given to the 12, seems to point to them as those from whom the 70 are to be distinguished as other. We judge that they were sent forth at this time, first, from the Gospel of St. Luke, where this whole section appears as a distinct and separate record, presumably chronologically arranged. Secondly, from the fitness of such a mission at that particular period when Jesus made his last missionary progress towards Jerusalem, and thirdly, from the unlikelihood, if not impossibility, of taking such a public step after the persecution which broke out after his appearance at Jerusalem on the Feast of Tabernacles. At any rate, it could not have taken place later than in the period between the Feast of Tabernacles and that of the dedication of the temple, since, after that, Jesus walked no more openly among the Jews. With all their similarity, there are notable differences between the mission of the 12 and this of the other 70. Let it be noted that the former is recorded by the three evangelists, so that there could have been no confusion on the part of St. Luke. But the mission of the 12 was on their appointment to the apostolate. It was evangelistic and missionary, and it was in confirmation and manifestation of the power and authority given to them. We regard it, therefore, as symbolical of the apostolate just instituted with its work and authority. On the other hand, no power or authority was formally conferred on the 70, their mission being only temporary and, indeed, for one definite purpose. Its primary object was to prepare for the coming of the Master in the places to which they were sent, and their selection was from the wider circle of disciples, the number being now 70 instead of 12. Even these two numbers, as well as the difference in the functions of the two classes of messengers, seems to indicate that the 12 symbolized the princes of the tribes of Israel, while the 70 were the symbolical representatives of these tribes, like the 70 elders appointed to assist Moses. This symbolical meaning of the number 70 continued among the Jews. We can trace it to the 70 supposed translators of the Bible into Greek, and in the 70 members of the Sanhedrin, or Supreme Court. There was something very significant in this appearance of Christ's messengers by two and two, in every place he was about to visit. As John the Baptist had, at the first, heralded the coming of Christ, so now two heralds appeared to solemnly announce his advent at the close of his ministry, as John had sought, as the representative of the Old Testament church, to prepare his way, so they, as the representatives of the New Testament church. In both cases, the preparation sought was a moral one. It was the national summons to open the gates to the rightful king and accept his rule. Only, the need was now the greater for the failure of John's mission, through the misunderstanding and disbelief of the nation. This conjunction with John the Baptist and the failure of his mission, as regarded national results, accounts for the insertion in St. Matthew's Gospel of part of the address delivered on the mission of the 70 immediately after the record of Christ's rebuke of the national rejection of the Baptist. For St. Matthew, who, as well as St. Mark, records not the mission of the 70 simply because, as before explained, the whole section, of which it forms part, is peculiar to St. Luke's Gospel, reports the discourses connected with it in other, and to them congruous, connections. We mark that what may be termed the preface to the mission of the 70 is given by St. Matthew in a somewhat fuller form as that to the appointment and mission of the 12 apostles, and it may have been that kindred words had preceded both. Partially, indeed, the expression reported in St. Luke 10:2 had been employed long before. Those multitudes throughout Israel, nay, those also which are not of that flock, appeared to his view like sheep without a true shepherd's care, distressed and prostrate, and their mute misery and only partly conscious longing appealed, and not in vain, to his divine compassion. This constituted the ultimate ground of the mission of the apostles, and now of the 70, into a harvest that was truly great. Compared with the extent of the field and the urgency of the work, how few were the laborers! Yet, as the field was God's, so also could he alone thrust forth laborers willing and able to do his work, while it must be ours to pray that he would be pleased to do so. On these introductory words, which ever since have formed the bidding prayer of the Church in her work for Christ, follow the commission and special directions to the 35 pairs of disciples who went on this embassy. In almost every particular, they are the same as those formerly given to the 12. We mark, however, that both the introductory and the concluding words addressed to the apostles are wanting in what was said to the 70. It was not necessary to warn them against going to the Samaritans, since the direction of the 70 was to those cities of Perea and Judea, on the road to Jerusalem, through which Christ was about to pass. Nor were they armed with precisely the same supernatural powers as the 12. Naturally, the personal directions as to their conduct were in both cases substantially the same. We mark only three peculiarities in those addressed to the 70. The direction to salute no man by the way was suitable to a temporary and rapid mission, which might have been sadly interrupted by making or renewing acquaintances. Both the Mishnah and the Talmud lay it down that prayer was not to be interrupted to salute even a king, nay, to uncoil a serpent that had wound round the foot. On the other hand, the rabbis discuss the question whether the reading of the Shema and of the portion of the Psalms called the Hallel might be interrupted at the close of a paragraph from respect for a person, or interrupted in the middle from motives of fear. All agreed that immediately before prayer no one should be saluted, to prevent distraction, and it was advised rather to summarize or to cut short than to break into prayer, though the latter might be admissible in the case of absolute necessity. None of these provisions, however, seems to have been in the mind of Christ. If any parallel is to be sought, it would be found in the similar direction of Elisha to Gehazi, when sent to lay the prophet's staff on the dead child of the Shunammite. The other two peculiarities in the address to the 70 seem verbal rather than real. The expression, "If the Son of Peace be there," is a Hebraism, equivalent to "if the house be worthy," and refers to the character of the head of the house and the tone of the household. Lastly, the direction to eat and drink such things as were set before them is only a further explanation of the command to abide in the house which had received them without seeking for better entertainment. On the other hand, the whole most important close of the address to the 12, which indeed forms by far the largest part of it, is wanting in the commission to the 70, thus clearly marking its merely temporary character. In St. Luke's Gospel, the address to the 70 is followed by a denunciation of Chorazin and Bethsaida. This is evidently in its right place there, after the ministry of Christ in Galilee had been completed and finally rejected. In St. Matthew's Gospel, it stands, for a reason already indicated, immediately after the Lord's rebuke of the popular rejection of the Baptist message. The woe pronounced on those cities in which most of his mighty works were done is in proportion to the greatness of their privileges. The denunciation of Chorazin and Bethsaida is the more remarkable that Chorazin is not otherwise mentioned in the Gospels, nor yet any miracles recorded as having taken place in the western Bethsaida. From this, two inferences seem inevitable. First, this history must be real. If the whole were legendary, Jesus would not be represented as selecting the names of places which the writer had not connected with the legend. Again, apparently no record has been preserved in the Gospels of most of Christ's miracles. only those being narrated, which were necessary in order to present Jesus as the Christ, in accordance with the respective plans on which each of the Gospels was constructed. As already stated, the denunciations were in proportion to the privileges, and hence to the guilt, of the unbelieving cities. Chorazin and Bethsaida are compared with Tyre and Sidon, which, under similar admonitions, would have repented, while Capernaum, which, as for so long the home of Jesus, had truly been exalted to heaven, is compared with Sodom. And such guilt involved greater punishment. The very sight of Bethsaida and Chorazin cannot be fixed with certainty. The former probably represents the fishermen of Capernaum, the latter seems to have almost disappeared from the shore of the lake. St. Jerome places it 2 miles from Capernaum. If so, it may be represented by the modern Chorazin, somewhat to the northwest of Capernaum. The site would correspond with the name, for Chorazin is at present a spring with an insignificant ruin above it, and the name Chorazin may well be derived from Keraz, a water jar, Chorazin or Chorazin, the water jars. If so, we can readily understand that the fishermen on the south side of Capernaum and the well-known springs Chorazin on the other side of it may have been the frequent scene of Christ's miracles. This explains also, in part, why the miracles there wrought had not been told, as well as those done in Capernaum itself. In the Talmud, a Chorazin, or rather Chorazim, is mentioned as celebrated for its wheat. But as for Capernaum itself, standing on that vast field of ruins and upturned stones which marks the site of the modern Tel Hum, we feel that no description of it could be more pictorially true than that in which Christ prophetically likened the city, in its downfall, to the desolateness of death and Hades. Whether or not the 70 actually returned to Jesus before the Feast of Tabernacles, it is convenient to consider in this connection the result of their mission. It had filled them with the joy of assurance, nay, the result had exceeded their expectations, just as their faith had gone beyond the mere letter unto the spirit of his words. As they reported it to him, even the demons had been subject to them through his name. In this they had exceeded the letter of Christ's commission, but as they made experiment of it, their faith had grown, and they had applied his command to heal the sick to the worst of all sufferers, those grievously vexed by demons. And, as always, their faith was not disappointed, nor could it be otherwise. The great contest had been long decided. It only remained for the faith of the church to gather the fruits of that victory. The Prince of Light and Life had vanquished the Prince of Darkness and Death. The Prince of this world must be cast out. In spirit, Christ gazed on Satan fallen as lightning from heaven. As one has aptly paraphrased it, "While you cast out his subjects, I saw the prince himself fall." It has been asked whether the words of Christ refer to any particular event, such as his victory in the temptation, but any such limitation would imply grievous misunderstanding of the whole. So to speak, the fall of Satan is to the bottomless pit, ever going on to the final triumph of Christ. As the Lord beholds him, he is fallen from heaven, from the seat of power and of worship, for his mastery is broken by the stronger than he, and he is fallen like lightning in its rapidity, dazzling splendor, and destructiveness. Yet, as we perceive it, it is only demons cast out in his name. For still is this fight and sight continued, and to all ages of the present dispensation. Each time the faith of the church casts out demons, whether as formerly or as they presently vex men, whether in the lighter combat about possession of the body or in the sorer fight about the possession of the soul, as Christ beholds it, it is ever Satan fallen. For he sees of the travail of his soul and is satisfied. And so also is there joy in heaven over every sinner that repenteth. The authority and power over the demons, attained by faith, was not to pass away with the occasion that had called it forth. The 70 were the representatives of the church in her work of preparing for the advent of Christ. As already indicated, the sight of Satan fallen from heaven is the continuous history of the church. what the faith of the 70 had attained was now to be made permanent to the church, whose representatives they were. 4. The words in which Christ now gave authority and power to tread on serpents and scorpions, and over all the power of the enemy, and the promise that nothing should hurt them, could not have been addressed to the 70 for a mission which had now come to an end, except insofar as they represented the church universal. It is almost needless to add that those serpents and scorpions are not to be literally but symbolically understood. Yet it is not this power or authority which is to be the main joy either of the church or the individual, but the fact that our names are written in heaven. And so Christ brings us back to his great teaching about the need of becoming children, and wherein lies the secret of true greatness in the kingdom. It is beautifully in the spirit of all this when we read that the joy of the disciples was met by that of the Master, and that his teaching presently merged into a prayer of thanksgiving. Throughout the occurrences since the Transfiguration, we have noticed an increasing antithesis to the teaching of the rabbis, but it almost reached its climax in the thanksgiving that the Father in heaven had hid these things from the wise and the understanding and revealed them unto babes. As we view it in the light of those times, we know that the wise and understanding, the rabbi and the scribe, could not, from their standpoint, have perceived them. Nay, that it is matter of never-ending thanks that not what they, but what the babes understood was, as alone it could be, the subject of the Heavenly Father's revelation. We even tremble to think how it would have fared with the babes if the wise and understanding had had part with them in the knowledge revealed. And so it must ever be, not only the law of the kingdom and the fundamental principle of divine revelation, but matter for thanksgiving that, not as wise and understanding, but only as babes, as converted, like children, we can share in that knowledge which maketh wise unto salvation. And this truly is the gospel and the Father's good pleasure. The words with which Christ turned from this address to the 70 and thanksgiving to God seem almost like the Father's answer to the prayer of his Son. They refer to and explain the authority which Jesus has bestowed on his church. All things were delivered to me of my Father, and they afford the highest rationale for the fact that these things had been hid from the wise and revealed unto babes. For, as no man, only the Father, could have full knowledge of the Son, and conversely, no man, only the Son, had true knowledge of the Father, it followed that this knowledge came to us not of wisdom or learning, but only through the revelation of Christ. No one knoweth who the Son is, save the Father, and who the Father is, save the Son, and he to whomsoever the Son willeth to reveal him. St. Matthew, who also records this, although in a different connection, immediately after the denunciation of the unbelief of Chorazin, Bethsaida, and Capernaum, concludes this section by words which have ever since been the grand text of those who, following in the wake of the 70, have been ambassadors for Christ. On the other hand, St. Luke concludes this part of his narrative by adducing words equally congruous to the occasion, which, indeed, are not new in the mouth of the Lord. From their suitableness to what had preceded, we can have little doubt that both that which St. Matthew and that which St. Luke reports was spoken on this occasion. Because knowledge of the Father came only through the Son, and because these things were hidden from the wise and revealed to babes, did the gracious Lord open his arms so wide and bid all that labored and were heavy laden to come to him. These were the sheep, distressed and prostrate, whom to gather that he might give them rest. He had sent forth the 70 on a work for which he had prayed the Father to thrust forth laborers, and which he has since entrusted to the faith and service of love of the church. And the true wisdom, which qualified for the kingdom, was to take upon his yoke, which would be found easy, and a lightsome burden, not like that unbearable yoke of rabbinic conditions. And the true understanding to be sought was by learning of him. In that wisdom of entertaining the kingdom by taking up its yoke, and in that knowledge which came by learning of him, Christ was himself alike the true lesson and the best teacher for those babes. For he is meek and lowly in heart. He has done what he taught, and he taught what he had done. And so, by coming unto him, would true rest be found for the soul. These words, as recorded by St. Matthew, the evangelist of the Jews, must have sunk the deeper into the hearts of Christ's Jewish hearers, that they came in their own old familiar form of speech, yet with such contrast of spirit. One of the most common figurative expressions of the time was that of the yoke, to indicate submission to an occupation or obligation. Thus, we read not only of the yoke of the law, but of that to earthly governments and ordinary civil obligations. Very instructive for the understanding of the figure is the paraphrase of Canticle 1:10, "How beautiful is their neck for bearing the yoke of thy statutes, and it shall be upon them like the yoke on the neck of the ox that ploweth in the field, and provideth food for himself and his master." This yoke might be cast off, as the 10 tribes had cast off that of God, and thus brought on themselves their exile. On the other hand, to take upon oneself the yoke meant to submit to it of free choice and deliberate resolution. Thus, in the allegorism of the Midrash, in the inscription Proverbs 30, verse 1, concerning Agur, the son of Jakeh, which is viewed as a symbolical designation of Solomon, the word Masa, rendered in the Authorized Version prophecy, is thus explained in reference to Solomon, Masa, because he lifted on himself the yoke of the Holy One, blessed be he. And of Isaiah it was said that he had been privileged to prophesy of so many blessings because he had taken upon himself the yoke of the kingdom of heaven with joy. And, as previously stated, it was set forth that in the Shema, or Creed, which was repeated every day, the words Deuteronomy 6:4-9 were recited before those in 11:13-21, so as first generally to take upon ourselves the yoke of the kingdom of heaven, and only afterwards that of the commandments. And this yoke all Israel had taken upon itself, thereby gaining the merit ever afterwards imputed to them. Yet, practically, the yoke of the kingdom was none other than that of the law and of the commandments, one of laborious performances and of impossible self-righteousness. It was unbearable, not the easy and lightsome yoke of Christ, in which the kingdom of God was of faith, not of works. And, as if themselves to bear witness to this, we have this saying of theirs, terribly significant in this connection, "Not like those formerly, the first, who made for themselves the yoke of the law easy and light, but like those after them, those afterwards, who made the yoke of the law upon them heavy." And indeed, this voluntary making of the yoke as heavy as possible, the taking on themselves as many obligations as possible, was the ideal of rabbinic piety. There was, therefore, peculiar teaching and comfort in the words of Christ, and well might he add, as St. Luke reports, that blessed were they who saw and heard these things. For that messianic kingdom, which had been the object of rapt vision and earnest longing to prophets and kings of old, had now become reality. Abounding as this history is in contrast, it seems not unlikely that the scene next recorded by St. Luke stands in its right place. Such an inquiry on the part of a certain lawyer as to what he should do to inherit eternal life, together with Christ's parabolic teaching about the Good Samaritan, is evidently congruous to the previous teaching of Christ about entering into the kingdom of heaven. Possibly this scribe may have understood the words of the Master about these things being hid from the wise, and the need of taking up the yoke of the kingdom, as enforcing the views of those rabbinic teachers who laid more stress upon good works than upon study. Perhaps himself belonged to that minority, although his question was intended to tempt, to try whether the Master would stand the rabbinic test, alike morally and dialectically. And, without at present entering on the parable which gives Christ's final answer, and which will best be considered together with the others belonging to that period, it will be seen how peculiarly suited it was to the state of mind just supposed. From this interruption, which, but for the teaching of Christ connected with it, would have formed a terrible discord in the heavenly harmony of this journey, we turn to a far other scene. It follows in the course of St. Luke's narrative, and we have no reason to consider it out of its proper place. If so, it must mark the close of Christ's journey to the Feast of Tabernacles, since the home of Martha and Mary, to which it introduces us, was in Bethany, close to Jerusalem, almost one of its suburbs. Other indications confirmatory of this note of time are not wanting. Thus, the history which follows that of the home of Bethany, when one of his disciples asks him to teach them to pray, as the Baptist has similarly taught his followers, seems to indicate that they were then on the scene of John's former labors, northeast of Bethany, and hence that it occurred on Christ's return from Jerusalem. Again, from the narrative of Christ's reception in the house of Martha, we gather that Jesus had arrived in Bethany with his disciples, but that he alone was the guest of the two sisters. We infer that Christ had dismissed his disciples to go into the neighboring city for the feast, while himself tarried in Bethany. Lastly, with all this agrees the notice in St. John 7:14 that it was not at the beginning, but about the middle of the feast that Jesus went up into the temple. Although traveling on the two first festive days was not actually unlawful, yet we can scarcely conceive that Jesus would have done so, especially on the Feast of Tabernacles, and the inference is obvious that Jesus had tarried in the immediate neighborhood, as we know he did at Bethany in the house of Martha and Mary. Other things also do so explain themselves, notably the absence of the brother of Martha and Mary, who probably spent the festive days in the city itself. It was the beginning of the Feast of Tabernacles, and the scene recorded by St. Luke would take place in the open leafy booth, which served as the sitting apartment during the festive week. For, according to law, it was the duty during the festive week to eat, sleep, pray, study, in short, to live in these booths, which were to be constructed of the boughs of living trees. And, although this was not absolutely obligatory on women, yet the rule which bade all make the booth the principal, and the house only the secondary dwelling, would induce them to make this leafy tent at least the sitting apartment alike for men and women. And indeed, those autumn days were just the season when it would be joy to sit in these delightful cool retreats, the memorials of Israel's pilgrim days. They were high enough, and yet not too high, chiefly open in front, close enough to be shady, and yet not so close as to exclude sunlight and air. Such would be the apartment in which what is recorded passed, and, if we add that this booth probably stood in the court, we can picture to ourselves Martha moving forwards and backwards on her busy errands and seeing, as she passed again and again, Mary still sitting a rapt listener, not heeding what passed around, and, lastly, how the elder sister could, as the language of verse 40 implies, enter so suddenly the Master's presence, bringing her complaint. To understand this history, we must dismiss from our minds preconceived, though perhaps attractive, thoughts. There is no evidence that the household of Bethany had previously belonged to the circle of Christ's professed disciples. It was, as the whole history shows, a wealthy home. It consisted of two sisters, the elder, Martha, a not uncommon Jewish name, being the feminine of Mar, and equivalent to our word mistress, the younger, Mary, and their brother Lazarus. Although we know not how it came, yet evidently the house was Martha's, and into it she received Jesus on his arrival in Bethany. It would have been no uncommon occurrence in Israel for a pious, wealthy lady to receive a great rabbi into her house. But the present was not an ordinary one. Martha must have heard of him, even if she had not seen him. But indeed, the whole narrative implies that Jesus had come to Bethany with the view of accepting the hospitality of Martha, which probably had been proffered when some of those 70 sojourning in the worthiest house at Bethany had announced the near arrival of the Master. Still, her bearing affords only indication of being drawn towards Christ, at most of a sincere desire to learn the good news, not of actual discipleship. And so Jesus came. And, with him and in him heaven's own light and peace. He was to lodge in one of the booths, the sisters in the house, and the great booth in the middle of the courtyard would be the common living apartment of all. It could not have been long after his arrival. It must have almost been immediately that the sisters felt that they had received more than an angel unawares. How best to do him honor was equally the thought of both. To Martha it seemed as if she could not do enough in showing him all hospitality. And indeed, this festive season was a busy time for the mistress of a wealthy household, especially in the near neighborhood of Jerusalem, whence her brother might, after the first two festive days, bring with him, any time that week, honored guests from the city. To these cares was now added that of doing sufficient honor to such a guest, for she also deeply felt his greatness. And so she hurried to and fro through the courtyard, literally distracted about much serving. Her younger sister also would do him all highest honor, but not as Martha. Her homage consisted in forgetting all else but him, who spake as none had ever done. As truest courtesy and affection consists not in its demonstrations, but in being so absorbed in the object of it as to forget its demonstration, so with Martha, so with Mary in the presence of Christ. And then a new light, another day, had risen upon her. A fresh life had sprung up within her soul. She sat at the Lord's feet and heard his word. We dare not inquire, and yet we well know, of what it would be. And so, time after time, perhaps hour after hour, as Martha passed on her busy way, she still sat listening and living. At last, the sister who, in her impatience, could not think that a woman could, in such manner, fulfill her duty or show forth her religious profiting, broke in with what sounds like a querulous complaint, "Lord, dost thou not care that my sister did leave me to serve alone?" Mary had served with her, but she had now left her to do the work alone. Would the master bid her resume her neglected work? But with tone of gentle reproof and admonition, the affectionateness of which appeared even in the repetition of her name, "Martha, Martha," as similarly on a later occasion, "Simon, Simon," did he teach her in words which, however simple in their primary meaning, are so full that they have ever since borne the most many-sided application, "Thou art careful and anxious about many things, but one thing is needful, and Mary hath chosen that good part, which shall not be taken away from her." It was, as we imagine, perhaps the first day of, or else the preparation for, the feast. More than that one day did Jesus tarry in the home of Bethany. Whether Lazarus came then to see him, and, still more, what both Martha and Mary learned, either then or afterwards, we reverently forbear to search into. Suffice it that, though the natural disposition of the sisters remained what it had been, yet henceforth Jesus loved Martha and her sister.